The man who won international fame for his so-called last lecture has died at age 47. Randy Pausch was a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. He turned his diagnosis of pancreatic cancer into that lecture and then a best-selling book. It all began when Pausch was told he had only months to live. His attitude toward death and his celebration of life inspired millions around the world. NPR's Lynn Neary has this remembrance.
Randy Pausch was, by all accounts, a happy man, attractive, charismatic, and blessed with a good marriage and three kids. On campus, Pausch was a popular computer science professor known for developing courses that drew students from the arts, computer science, and engineering. So when Pausch was asked to give a talk for a lecture series called Journeys, no one was surprised that it was standing room only. The idea behind the series was for professors to speak to their students as if it were their last lecture. In Pausch's case, it really was. And he began by showing the audience scans of his liver tumors and explaining his grim diagnosis.
That is what it is. We can't change it. And we just have to decide how we're going to respond to that. We cannot change the cards we are dealt, just how we play the hand. If I don't seem as depressed or morose as I should be, sorry to disappoint you.
Pausch went on to say he wasn't going to talk about his cancer. Instead, he wanted to talk about his life and the lessons he had learned while growing up. Peter Lee, head of the computer science department at Carnegie Mellon, was in the audience that night.
You left that lecture hall just wanting to share this with everybody in the world. It was just one of these situations where very few times in your life do you experience something where you want everyone in the world to see this.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jeffrey Zaslow was also in the audience. He wrote a piece about the lecture and posted a video of it on the Wall Street Journal website.
That spread so fast, with people saying they were so touched, that I knew he was going to sort of move the world. It began so, like, lightning fast.
Eventually, Zaslow collaborated with Pausch on the book The Last Lecture. None of the lessons in The Last Lecture are startlingly new, but Pausch had a way of taking a cliché, like running into brick walls, and imbuing it with new meaning.
The brick walls are not there to keep us out. The brick walls are there to give us a chance to show how badly we want something. Because the brick walls are there to stop the people who don't want it badly enough.
In the end, Zaslow says, Pausch's ability to embrace life, even as he faced death, was a lesson in itself.
He lived with such bravado and such love of everybody in his life and just the idea of everything life has to offer. But he also showed, you know, we're all dying. His fate is our fate. It's just sped up. And so I think he showed us when our time comes, you know, we should have a little bit of Randy inside of us.
Pausch is survived by his wife and three children, for whom he has said his last lecture is his final legacy. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
If you're feeling outdoorsy, thanks to the summer weather, we have some reading recommendations for you. They come from our series, Three Books, where authors pick books that all follow a single theme. Juliet Eilprin is the Washington Post's environmental reporter, and her recommendations are all new and all about the environment.
Despite being a national environmental reporter, I didn't grow up sporting L.L. Bean or going spelunking with my friends. As a result, I often see reading environmental books as homework. But three new books on store shelves this summer eschew both purple prose and hyperbole to challenge the way we view our planet. Bill McKibben is one of journalism's premier commentators on global warming, but in American Earth, he turns back the clock. The anthology collects song lyrics, poetry, political speeches, and essays about nature from two centuries of Americans, from early thinkers like Henry David Thoreau to contemporary writers such as Michael Pollan. Science writer William Stolzenberg takes a more global view of environmental havoc in Where the Wild Things Were. Scientists and researchers who track large animals are the heroes of this story, but the most thrilling moments of the book are reserved for the beasts themselves. In one passage, a pronghorn antelope races against a truck, keeping pace without faltering. It's a beautiful and haunting scene. The antelope is out of place in a world where there are few predators left to chase this magnificent herd. While Stolzenberg examines nature on a sweeping scale, former Time journalist Eric Roston drills down to the atomic heart of the planet in the carbon age. I have avoided anything to do with organic chemistry for years, but Roston's book convinced me that the fastest way to understand everything larger than an atom and smaller than a planet is through the element carbon. Rosten writes that our use of carbon to create goods has made us more powerful than plate tectonics when it comes to the potential for destruction. While Hollywood filmmakers expect Armageddon to come from the skies, Rosten says we should all look inward. We are the meteor. Reading words printed on dead trees doesn't automatically translate into saving the planet. These three books offer a vision of a different path forward, one that might steer us safely out of the meteor's path.
That was Juliet Eilprin, National Environmental Reporter for The Washington Post. The books she recommended are American Earth by Bill McKibben, Where the Wild Things Were by William Stolzenberg, and The Carbon Age by Eric Rosten.
On January 4, 2007, Nancy Pelosi broke what she called the marble ceiling, becoming the nation's first female Speaker of the House. She charts her journey in her new book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. Pelosi learned about power from her father. Thomas D'Alessandro was a Democratic congressman and a mayor of Baltimore. Before joining in his footsteps, Pelosi chose marriage and motherhood, moving across the country to San Francisco. But she couldn't shake her political roots. After finding the perfect home, Pelosi refused to move in. When we met the speaker in her office, we found out why. Back then, the house's owner was joining the Nixon administration.
I really thought it was very important for the Democrats to win the election in 1968. I was devastated by that defeat for so many reasons. You have to remember now we're talking about the Vietnam War. We're talking about all of the issues that we cared about so much. And would I do the same thing over again? Probably.
But you have had to learn in your job how to walk across the aisle.
Oh, yes.
How did you get from not being willing to live in a house that was owned by somebody who was associated with a Republican to being able to walk across the aisle? That's a contradiction.
Well, it's a different responsibility. Then I was a homemaker, and my home was not going to be a home made available because of the election of Richard Nixon. Now I'm the House Speaker, and I have a different responsibility to make sure that the voices of all of the members of Congress are heard out of respect for their constituents.
You have a very funny story about male members of Congress talking about childbirth. Please tell us that.
With all due respect to my colleagues, and I have enormous regard for them, after all, they had the courage to elect a woman Speaker of the House. Having said that, they still have their moments. I remember one night we were having dinner with some of our male colleagues, and all of a sudden they started talking about childbirth. Now, it had been the custom at these dinners that if you want to get a word in edgewise, you had to jump in. But that evening when they were talking about childbirth, we thought, well, at least they'll ask us what we think, or if we even want to have this conversation, mind you, at the dinner table. So they went, wow, you should have seen when I went. I had the camera, I had on the green gown. I was all prepared to take the pictures. I went in there and said, I'm out of here. And the other bragging about how much fortitude he had when his wife gave birth and this or that. And we looked at each other and sort of smiled and thought, surely they will say to us, what do you think?
And they didn't.
And they did not. And so when I remind them of the story, they say, that couldn't possibly have happened. We would never have done that.
But indeed they did.
And indeed they did.
You go on to write about something called secret sauce. Explain what that means.
Well, I think the secret sauce as a recipe that the old boys club in the Congress has had that they were not sharing with anyone. Remember, I came 21 years ago. There were only 20 women in the Congress at the time. And so it seemed there was an aura. And it wasn't only just geared to women. It was geared to new members, too. Now, with newer members, eventually they'd become more experienced members and they'd be let in, but certainly not the women. And I observed this. I'm a student of human behavior, and observing this, I thought, they don't have any secret sauce. They just want us to think they do, and that's my message to the young women. Do not be even intimidated for a moment that there is this secret sauce that only they know.
You have reached, you know, the top of your profession here in the House. Women have done well in business. They've done well in science. Politics, in some ways, has been the exception. It's been harder for women to break what I read that you call the marble ceiling. Why is it much harder in politics?
Well, politics is hard. It's about power, and power is never given away. So everyone is competing for it, men and women. But to get directly to your point, I am encouraged that there will be many more women in higher office because of the example of so many women in office. Look at the beautiful candidacy of Hillary Clinton. I mean, that really gave women the idea that they could do it too.
But you bring up an interesting point. It's often been said that she could run as effectively as she did because she had name recognition as the first lady. And there have been other women who've served in their husband's seats, that it is a pattern in a generation of political women that they come because they come from a family. They have a name because of a husband. Do you think
that? No, I don't think that. If I may, Deborah, I think that used to be the case. By and large, the idea of being a widow or a daughter or something, that hasn't been the case. And I don't think it was in mine. I didn't run where my father had been in office. I ran, built my reputation in a different place. But overwhelmingly, the women who are here now are here. Not that the others didn't have an enormous contribution to make, but they're here in their own right, making their own mark. And if they happen to be from a family that has been committed to public service, that's the case for many men in Congress as well.
But there's no obvious woman on the horizon to run in a presidential campaign.
Well, look at this. Who knew 4 years ago who Barack Obama was? Who knew in 1991 who Bill Clinton was? Just because some of these women are not household words now doesn't mean that they could not emerge as a presidential candidate.
Do you think, beyond the symbolism, that a woman as a president of the United States would be dramatically different than a man?
It's interesting that you ask that, because lately I've been thinking, I get introduced every place I go as the first woman speaker of the House, and people make a big fuss about it. But really, now I can just be introduced as Speaker of the House. It's self-evident that I am a woman. I think a woman president of the United States, in terms of symbolism, well, you can't separate it. You can't separate.
The first time.
The first time. But the experience as a woman that the person would bring to the table is something that says to women in America, I know your experience. I bring that judgment to the table. I think in an intuitive way. And that special quality and that special grace that women bring to it all is something that would be such a source of strength to our country.
Thank you very much. We've been talking to Nancy Pelosi about her book, Know Your Power.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
Now to a comic nautical theme, pirates. Writer Brooks Brown cares deeply about pirates, and we care about them, at least enough to allow Mr. Brown to follow his passion for our series, Three Books. That's our summer reading series where authors recommend books on a single theme. Here's Brooks Brown.
Picture him, a swashbuckler standing on the bow of a boat with an eye patch, a wooden leg, and a parrot on his shoulder. He's the pirate. They existed in the past, and they inhabit the modern world. It just turns out we have no idea exactly what is underneath that fabled eye patch. If Pirates of the Caribbean is the soda and popcorn version of pirates, then Under the Black Flag, well, that's the bottle of rum. Delving deep into the myths we've grown up with, David Cordingly dutifully destroys the happy face of pirates we've come to love. In its place, he leaves a history that is not only accurate, but considerably more fascinating. As it turns out, pirates really did have parrots and monkeys. Kept as pets, they were often used to bribe slippery government officials. And female pirates like Anne Bonny and Mary Read, they actually did spend years hiding themselves in men's clothing on ships, killing, plundering, and being tried for crimes on the high seas right alongside the men. Even the buried treasure some still hunt for today, it actually did exist. As Under the Black Flag shows, the truth behind the myths can sometimes be even better than the myths themselves. In Dangerous Waters, John Burnett hitches a ride on two cargo ships as they navigate the high sea and discovers that today's pirates are a far cry from the pirates we've come to know. Forget the fleets of ships flying the Jolly Roger. Modern piracy often takes the form of a high seas mugging by a small number of men in canoes. Deftly weaving in and out of the misconceptions and realities of the modern pirate, Dangerous Waters gives an honest and in-the-trenches view of piracy in the new millennium. Meanwhile, as Lawrence Lessig writes in Free Culture, a new breed of pirate is taking their battle to land. Rather than the waters of the ocean, they spend their time surfing the internet, and their plunder is not doubloons. Their theft is that of movies, music, and software. Written as a brilliantly thought-out argument, Lessig takes us through the various worlds of internet piracy and their implications. As he points out, the young man with BitTorrent downloading software today is not a far cry from those who used VCRs, Walkman, and even the phonograph. The only thing in their path? As Lessig shows us, it is that caricature we've painted of the pirate, the carefree lawbreaker who believes they are fighting against tyranny. And it turns out, these pirates are all around us. The truth behind the tales be infinitely more interesting. Aye, me parrot concurs.
Writer Brooks Brown lives in San Francisco. His three for books about pirates are Under the Black Flag by David Cordingley, Dangerous Waters by John Burnett, and Free Culture by Lawrence Lessig.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.